Hello and welcome to Best of Shows, a weekly conversation about the biggest things happening on the small screen and a guide to what TV is and is not worth your time. I'm Kristen Baldwin, TV critic at Entertainment Weekly, and I'm joined by my fellow EW critic and TV junkie, Darren Freinich. Hi, Darren.
Kristen, how's it going today? This is a relatively dark day for our otherwise sunny podcast.
It is a dark day because, as listeners may know, we're currently in the midst of our Best of the Decade countdown. We've done best reality shows, we've done best series finales, but today we're taking a turn for the worst, Darren, and we're going to count down five each of the worst shows of the decade in different categories. We've got worst revival, worst season two after a great season one, worst comedy, worst reality show, and of course, worst drama. So it's going to be rough, but I feel like we can get through it together, Darren.
I think we can. And I will say, Kristen, you know, I like that we're doing it this way because I do feel like our next two episodes are just going to be nonstop classics.
Nonstop.
And, you know, as critics, we obviously watch a lot of television. We watch a lot of bad television. I find that for the most part, bad TV kind of deletes from my brain
right, pretty
quickly. And so even kind of putting this week's lineup together, it was an interesting journey back through some of the worst hours of my life that were spent watching television this year. And so I'm glad to be able to do this. I think there's going to be a lot of fun conversations to be had. And obviously we want to hear from people who have their own very memorable bad TV experiences. But this is going to be a hard one, Kristen. Do you want to start us off with your worst revival?
Yes. And, you know, there are a lot of revivals, a lot that happened. And,
so many.
You know, look, before everyone starts shouting, why aren't you saying Roseanne? I'm going to say that Roseanne, the revival, the show itself was actually fine. It was actually pretty good. You know, Roseanne the person was a dumpster fire. So, like, I'm not putting Roseanne as my worst revival of the decade because the show was actually pretty good. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to go in another direction. My worst revival is actually CBS's Murphy Brown. And this ran from September to December of 2018. And, you know, the Trump era did inspire a lot of comedy revivals, including NBC's Will and Grace, ABC's Roseanne, and then CBS's revival of their long-running news-themed comedy Murphy Brown. And, you know, this was a show created by Diane English that had always mined political headlines for its humor. But in the 20 years that Murphy Brown was off the air, the thing that originally made it so unique, you know, its incisive comedy about political headlines, it kind of became commonplace. And with her new incarnation of Murphy Brown, Diane English didn't really try to evolve what she once did so well. And instead, she just kind of went back to doing the same sort of shouty truth-to-power comedy that she was doing during the Clinton administration. And weirdly enough, the only truly entertaining parts of the revival focused on Murphy's relationship with her grown son and fellow journalist Avery Brown, but those were few and far between. I mean, the rest of it, you know, the cast is still a great cast, but they really, you know, they were given sort of storylines and writing that felt very almost old-fashioned in a way. And it, you know, took on current issues like the White House banning reporters from the press room or violence against reporters at political rallies. And there was a truly god-awful Me Too episode, too. But it really just felt very sort of strident and agenda-driven and devoid of any kind of nuance. Did you watch any of it, Darren?
I did, Kristen. And, you know, I was not a viewer of the original Murphy Brown really at all, though I certainly kind of understood its influence. And so I think I'm someone who just kind of watched the revival and felt very strongly, oh, maybe I wasn't missing anything at all. And you know, I know that, you know, especially from kind of hearing from you, that there is so much more going on in the original show. But this was one of those shows that structured itself as a response to a lot of things that were happening towards the end of this decade, Trump specifically, but just more generally the political situation. And it was one of the responses where I felt like, oh, this is like almost as problematic in many ways as the things it is arguing against.
Yes.
And you know, I don't want to say it's problematic as the horrible things that were happening, but in terms of the tone of it and in terms of the way that it seemed really kind of divorced from any sense of the reality of modern media, the reality of political media, you know, you kind of mentioned the way that her relationship with her son, but there was a lot of potential there. Her son, I believe, was working for a conservative news network.
Right.
And I just think that's, you know, if you can do that the right way, that's potentially very interesting. But its portrayal of him, its portrayal of his dynamic on the network versus with Murphy Brown, none of it felt particularly emotionally real or funny is perhaps the kind of bigger issue. So I will say, I'm glad you kind of bring this one up as your first one, because, you know, there was a lot of bad TV, but what frustrated me most this decade was when you saw incredible talent put to use for bad television.
Yes.
Does that kind of make sense to you?
Absolutely. Like, we were having Slack chats before this episode. Like, are we going with genuinely bad, just sort of really stupid TV, or TV that had so much potential that it squandered? And this is one of those examples. I mean, I definitely have some really stupid TV on this list as well, but this is an example of like a really talented group of people who had a real opportunity and just just failed to execute.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a lot about squandered potential when I talk about my worst revival, Kristen, because, you know, you mentioned there were so many revivals this decade. Every now and then there was one that was so awesome enough where I would then have to say, well, I guess I'm in favor of revivals.
Yeah.
You know, if there is a Twin Peaks, or if there is the very occasional episode of The X-Files that brought me to tears, like, I guess that, yeah, this is something that I support. But Kristen, there was one revival that was so awful that it kind of poisoned the original show for me.
Oh, man.
In a way that I would have not thought possible. I'm talking about Arrested Development, which came back to life on Netflix in sort of 2.5 seasons of steadily declining, almost ultimately comedy-free, pastiche humor variations of what made it one of the best shows of the 2000s. I mean, like, I am incredibly bullish about the first three seasons of Arrested Development, which aired on Fox, as maybe being the last great network sitcom. And certainly, you know, I can still quote chapter and verse from those episodes.
Right.
Netflix made a lot of headlines when they announced they were going to bring the show back. The fourth season, which aired in 2013, I know a lot of people kind of defended on the grounds of doing something interesting. It was a somewhat strange example of a revival where the sheer success of all of the actors involved who played the Bluth family, the Bluths, of course, the kind of family in Orange County who just were steadily dwindling in more and more hilarious ways throughout the original series. The actors couldn't all really be on screen together that often because they were so busy. And I acknowledge that, you know, what they produced with that fourth season was an attempt to work around that. I'm not sure it really worked very much at all. And you really felt how there were certain characters and certain actors, Job or Tobias, who could kind of carry something like that. Whereas George Sr., a lot of other family members just didn't really seem, those focal episodes with Lindsay, with a lot of other people, just didn't really work. But then it kind of re-returned for a bifurcated season from 2018 through this year. And I have to say, Kristen, that season was utterly laughless.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I want to give some credit to the fact that a few of the actors were still, I think, trying very hard. But this was the first time with any revival where it legitimately felt like I was watching, you know, like as if the show had been airing the whole time and now they were in season 17 and everyone was just bored. It was just very, and I do think that, you know, there were a lot of specific problems with it. I think it became very navel-gazing. I think the in-jokes got to be too much. I think turning Ron Howard into a character was not ultimately a great decision, and then the new season went really overboard with that. But just as a kind of real example of everything that was great about the original just dissipating, this is the one that really stands out to me. Did you follow along ultimately with this last run of Arrested Development?
No, and you know what? In part because I was just so kind of put off by the whole off-screen sort of drama. You know, the cast gave an interview with the New York Times, and Jessica Walter, the fantastic actress, living legend, who plays Lucille Bluth, started crying, talking about how terrible Jeffrey Tambor was to her on set at times. And in the course of that interview, Jason Bateman jumps in and starts saying, like, oh, you know, it was just part of the show. It was just, you know, everybody has a different process. And, like, only Aaliyah Shawkat was the lone other woman in a group of all these men was brave enough to say, hey, actually, so what if he has a process? That process is not okay. Yeah. And, you know, the idea, and then, of course, Jason Bateman apologized on Twitter after everybody was like, what's your problem? So that whole, you know, given that the previous season four was just not very good, and then this whole thing, it just really, it left such a bad taste in my mouth. I was like, forget it. Well, I'm not even going to bother.
And Kristen, I will say that, you know, some of those feelings manifested in the show itself. This is a much larger topic that I've tried and failed to write about because it's just so abstract. But one problem with a lot of the revivals in this decade was I had the feeling, as someone who's watched and loved television my entire life, of seeing shows that were once incredibly rebellious, and I would have said progressive stylistically, if not definitely progressive politically, seeing them return and kind of become like reactionary, it was a really difficult thing to witness. I mean, Arrested Development, it's about, you know, a family of rich, ridiculous people in Orange County. And so, you know, some of the kind of sourness of the revival, I assume that was just attempts at satire that were failing. But it was just, it was a strange feeling to kind of see these shows. X-Files was another example when it was on its kind of off weeks, of these shows that had been so bold and exciting and new kind of return and just seem almost seem like very angry middle-aged versions of themselves. And those were the kind of revivals of the 20-teens that really stood out as just being quite depressing.
I don't know. I mean, I guess, have you gone back to watch the original run?
Still good.
So, you're not, like, it doesn't completely ruin your enjoyment of the original run.
It doesn't. It certainly is a pretty strong asterisk put next to it. And you know, I think that when we talk about bad TV, as we'll kind of discuss in our next category, you know, yes, there's bad television that's just bad through and through, but it's really hard to see something that had been good become very, very much not good.
Such a great segue, because now we're going to do a worst season two after a fantastic season one. So my choice for this, and, you know, actually I was surprised. I thought, oh, this isn't, there are not that many examples. And I went back and I was like, oh, wait, yes, there are a lot of examples. My choice after mulling over many options is True Detective, season two, which aired in 2015 on HBO. You know, there's been a lot of excellent auteur created television over the last decade, from people like Ryan Murphy, Pamela Adlon, Robert and Michelle King, and of course, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And while with the first season of HBO's True Detective, it seemed like creator and writer Nick Pizzolatto was poised to enter the auteur pantheon. But when the first season, starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson as Louisiana homicide detectives investigating a woman's murder, when it became a huge cultural phenomenon, HBO wanted a second season, toot sweet. So execs at the network pushed Pizzolatto to write 8 new episodes ASAP. And the result was sort of a turgid, convoluted yarn about real estate and rape and murder, featuring a lot of grim and aloof performances by Colin Farrell, Rachel McAdams, and Vince Vaughn, whose character, by the way, suffers a spectacularly ridiculous death in the middle of the desert. You know, I still watched every episode, but it was more out of this vain hope that the season might get better than out of any real interest in what was going on. And it's a real, really fascinating example of the conflict between creativity and business, because if HBO had given Pizzolatto the time he needed, who knows what he would have come up with. And at least the network does own up to its mistake. HBO programming chief Michael Lombardo said after the season's disappointing run, he said, I set him up to deliver in a very short time frame something that became very challenging to deliver, and that's not what the show is. So he admitted, we pushed him and the result was kind of a disaster. But can you imagine, like, had True Detective been allowed to kind of take its own time, I do wonder if it would have remained a phenomenon just simply because I feel like season three obviously was very disappointing and certainly not as much of a mess as season one or season two. But I do wonder if the momentum just, you know, was never going to be able to get back after that season two disaster.
It's so hard to tell, Kristen. I think, you know, you kind of mentioned the idea of auteur-driven storytelling. And One of the interesting things about True Detective Season 2 was that it was one of the first times where it seemed very clear that someone who had been a key collaborator with a show, you know, Nick Pizzolatto wrote Season 1. It was directed by Cary Fukunaga, who has gone on to have... Well, maybe we'll talk about him later. That season seemed to me to reflect a few different creative impulses. And I would throw in Matthew McConaughey just doing some really incredible on-screen work alongside Woody Harrelson. And it just seemed like Pizzolatto kind of looked at that first season and said, I did all of this.
Yeah.
And season two just feels kind of egomaniacal and inward facing. And, you know, it did not have a single directorial voice.
A lot of different directors.
I think that was a problem. I will say, Kristen, I've not come around to season two at all. But just because season three, which was certainly a more coherent piece,
yes,
that was such a kind of dutiful, obvious attempt to redo season one. Season two looks to me a little more fun as a result because it is just so loopy. I mean, you mentioned, Vince Vaughn has these speeches that go on and on and on. And do you remember, Kristen? I'm forgetting it now, but this was the season where a character who we'd met like once died and then was talked about for like a whole episode. It's just like, who are we discussing now? Why is this
I never knew what was going on. And I'll be honest, I didn't fully follow whatever was going on in season one because it got very weird, the murder investigation and then the weird like group of people that was raping children, like really disturbing and upsetting. But I always knew like bad guys doing bad things to women and children. Whereas with this, I was like, wait, something about real estate? Then there was like the parties that Rachel McAdams would go to with all the call girls and
her father was running fake Esalen up in like Big Sur. Yeah, there was just all kinds of strange things that it definitely, I mean, it was certainly an example of the blank check television that we've always talked about, of just like a lot being thrown at something where the basic foundations of what's going on are not always clear. Kristen, we're going to stick with HBO, unfortunately, for my pick for worst season two after a good season one. And as you mentioned, surprisingly, a lot of examples of bad season twos this decade. I think some of it has to do with the fact that with television now, you can do so much with a story. You know, the first season can like kill lots of characters, can take these great twists, can take these great leaps. But doing that with a great first season is not always... it's not setting you up for a long run the way that earlier shows that were less crazy could sort of, you know, last for a long time or could figure out kind of what their cruising altitude was. You know, different shows to choose from, but I keep coming back to Westworld season two in 2018 because
I'm just laughing because like I really enjoyed it. I know it went downhill, but anyway, go ahead.
But no, well, and we've talked about this before. And in fairness, what you have told me you enjoy about it, it's made me kind of rethink it in a lot of ways. But it's hard for me because I loved Westworld season one. Mm-hmm. I really felt like here was something that was tackling so many different, you know, concepts and just, you know, the idea of this park kind of being almost a video game experience, and even just the lingo and the way you kind of got into the whole idea of this narrative that's being constructed, and Anthony Hopkins as this god figure, and Jeffrey Wright and Tandy Newton and all these people doing such great work. And for me, season two just really felt like a big waste of time. I always think it's kind of telling when the best episode of a show is the one one where none of the main characters are really in it. Westworld season two had that really, really good episode about the robots who were kind of meant to be the Native Americans.
That was a great episode. The
main character of whom was played by Zahn McLarnon, who was also great in Fargo season two, and he's so great in a lot of things. But beyond that, you know, Dolores as a character just seemed to become impossible to understand, and she kind of just became a plot person who was going from one place to the next. I do think Westworld season two was kind of an example of a science fiction show that's very clearly about one kind of concept, in this case, robots and the robots coming to life. Suddenly it also became about like, oh, and the robots can imitate people and you can take their personality out of one thing and put it in another thing. And this kind of led to a lot of twists that basically left you feeling like, oh, well, anybody could be anybody now. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to know who we're kind of really investing in. And it was just, I think it was a bummer for me because I really felt like there was so much going right with season one.
Yeah.
And even, you know, the reappearances of people who were great in season one, like our favorite person, Jimmy Simpson, who's so awesome as the younger William. And season two really was trying to figure out, how do we bring this guy back in a meaningful way? And I just don't think it did. So for me, this is the one that really stands out as taking a show that I thought was, you know, best of the decade material and making me feel a little less good about it. Now, all that being said, Kristen, season three seems like it's going to be a pretty big shift. Where are you kind of at now with your expectations?
Well, I was going to ask you, like, season three seems totally different. I don't even really get what's happening. Like, Aaron Paul's there and he's talking to like
real estate.
He's talking to a guy that, or to like an actual robot that like is made of metal. Like, unclear if Dolores or anybody, you know, who kind of left Westworld in the end of season two, if they're going to be out in this world.
Yeah.
I mean, it definitely looks very different. And, you know, given that the second half of the second season had a lot of problems, even though I still enjoyed it, I do think a shift, like a complete narrative shift, maybe does make sense. And so I'm interested for sure. I mean, are you definitely going to check it out?
I will certainly check it out, you know, here for Aaron Paul doing anything.
Yeah.
You know, having just said, after season two, I want something very different, the fact that they've clearly decided to do something very different seems like something that I'll react to. I will just say, Kristen, that I find for a lot of people, roughly maybe within 10 years of being my age, there's kind of this feeling of like, whoa, are they doing something that looks like Blade Runner? I'm totally in. And I kind of don't feel that way anymore. I almost feel like looking like Blade Runner is now the biggest cliche
do
for a future tale. So I'm the fact that first trailer looked very kind of new kind of Blade Runner on the small screen, I was hesitant about that, but I will certainly be I'll be checking it out, because, you know, when there's a bad season two, there's nothing better than a show that kind of refines its footing.
Rallies and comes
exactly
back.
And you know, I think as a TV watcher, that's one of the best feelings a TV show can give you, is when it's like, oh, we've kind of refigured out what we were doing, or we're kind of boldly doing something new.
Like Friday Night Lights.
Let's just forget
they put the body over the bridge and just
Friday Night Lights season three is kind of the gold standard as far as being like, you know, we are kind of back to, I think FNL season three starts with Coach Taylor saying, we're focused on football. And that's kind of what you want a show to do sometimes.
That's exactly right, Coach.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, so let's move into worst comedy of the decade. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of options for the worst comedy of the decade, and many of them were on CBS, actually. you've got your Angel from Hell in 2016, which completely wasted the talents of star Jane Lynch. You've got your completely unnecessary reboot of The Odd Couple in 2016, in which Matthew Perry defiled a comedic treasure so that he could cash a paycheck he couldn't possibly need. And, of course, you've got your Man with a Plan, which is on right now, a banal time killer that's currently adding to Matt LeBlanc's considerable bank account. But I'm going to go with something else. a short-lived ABC sitcom called Work It, which aired for two highly unfortunate episodes in January of 2013. If you don't remember Work It, count your blessings, but it starred Ben Koldyke and Amory Nolasco, an actor I like, as two unemployed St. Louis guys who scheme their way into new jobs as pharmaceutical reps by dressing as women because the company only hires ladies. So yes, it was a blip on the TV radar, but Work It earns the title as worst comedy of the decade because it embodies pretty much all of the worst tendencies of a broadcast television sitcom. It takes an idiotic concept and uses it as a springboard for unfunny jokes about tired gender stereotypes. Men are bores who only care about beer and boobs. Women are nags or objects of lust. The two sexes can only exist to be at odds. I mean, at least Bosom Buddies gave us Tom Hanks and Peter Scolari, and all that Work It can claim as its legacy is a joke that compares prostate exams to, and I quote, the pinball scene in The Accused. Google it, kids. So it perfectly encapsulates everything that's wrong, you know, with broadcast three-camera sitcoms. It's a disaster. You can find the pilot if you Google, although, like, really, you don't need to know it. You can just watch the preview trailer and get the sense of what it is. Do you remember this show, Darren?
I remember it. I didn't actually watch it, Kristen, but I recall, you know, at a time when it was still kind of possible to absorb pretty much everything that was happening in a new season of television. This is the one that really stuck out that year. I'm glad you were pulling it out of the abyss to throw it back into the abyss once again.
Yes. It's one of those things where, like, you look at it and you're like, how did this get made? But then you're also like, I get why it got made, because a bunch of dudes in a room, and certainly at that time it was probably mostly dudes in a room, thought, oh, you know, guys putting on makeup, guys wearing heels, you know, and then also making jokes that equate rape to prostate exams. That's funny. That's funny stuff. Let's give it a try. Yeah. It apparently aired its full season in New Zealand. Which is something I learned in my rabbit hole of research. But anyway, yeah. So Work It. It was a disaster. January 2013, two episodes. Bye-bye.
There were a lot of shows in that time period that just immediately seemed so totally out of date and now seem like almost hilariously as an assault on all good taste and manners. But it was all kind of stuff like that. It was all just like dudes making incredibly dudely jokes. I don't know. I feel as if, I'm not sure everything's better on television now, but certainly it seems like you can't quite get away with doing that so baldly as they were doing at that time. Did you feel that, Kristen, or am I being incredibly optimistic?
You know, right, it is hard to know, like, is there some truly offensive show that we're missing? I don't think, I mean, this show is problematic in a variety of ways, and, you know, it was problematic in 2013 as opposed to, you know, shows that certainly were seen, you know, everything seemed fine in the context of the culture at the time, you know, but this is definitely one where, you know, even just the idea of men dressing as women, you know, for a job, it just seemed like, I feel like there's a whole population that would feel pretty, pretty offended by this with good reason.
Yeah. Kristen, we're going to stay in roughly the same totally ridiculous, toxic corner of the world for my worst comedy. And I will say, Kristen, this is a bit of a game time decision for me because, as I teased earlier, I was really, really close to talking about how I thought the worst comedy of the 20-teens was Netflix's Maniac, which was just such a total waste of talent for pretty much everybody involved. But I think I can't really get in a soap box with that, because Maniac was certainly trying very hard to do lots of terrible things. So instead, I'm going to talk about a show that just really stands out to me as just kind of awful and ridiculous, and also just so all-encompassing when it happened. I'm talking about Charlie Sheen and Anger Management, which debuted in 2012. And I think someday, Kristen, someone will write, like, the great book of the 20-teens will be kind of all about the insanity around Charlie Sheen mm-hmm. at the start of this decade. I really think that like that as a kind of journalistic event was something that seemed to really set the tone in a lot of sorrowful ways for what would happen later in this decade. This idea of a guy just kind of going crazy and doing it on social media and that kind of weirdly being the biggest story for a couple of months.
Yeah.
I think it's something that, you know, as much as it's kind of gladly been forgotten, I think that still kind of lives with us. One way that it continued to live with us was that FX immediately signed Charlie Sheen after he was fired from Two and a Half Men to do anger management. And it's sort of barely even a show in some ways. You know, it was very much intended to resemble Two and a Half Men. It's a very similar style of comedy to Two and a Half Men. And the most notable thing about it is that FX purchased 100 episodes of it. So it just kept
like
on
off
running.
Off the bat,
it just kind of kept on running and running and running. And I will admit, I did not watch all 100 episodes. I think I did not watch any episodes very much at all past season one, except for occasionally accidentally watching it on FX. But this was kind of an example, Kristen, of, in a different way from what you're describing, you know, it was kind of taking this sort of tabloid thing, taking someone who had been a star on CBS mm-hmm. and just kind of plugging them in horrifically to a non-concept. It was kind of a workplace comedy. You know, he was running an anger management group. It just felt very much rooted in the idea of this will work because Charlie Sheen is a comedic individual. And in fact, you know, he isn't really. I mean, Two and a Half Men, to the extent that it ever worked, he was not the one doing the hard work there, not the one doing the heavy lifting there.
It was John Cryer.
And I think that, you know, if you're ever going to respect Chuck Lorre, you're going to respect him for doing something with Charlie Sheen after seeing someone else try to do something with Charlie Sheen. And so something about this show and the fact that it got such a big order and the fact that it was, you know, a part of the cable landscape for a long enough time to be a thing, that's always really kind of stuck out to me as just, you know, something that really is unsettling. And, you know, there was a lot of information about the show that came out, you know, along the way, and Selma Blair ultimately left. And there was just all this kind of not so great stuff in the behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And the fact that the stuff in front of the scenes was just so dead and so not funny and not anything was pretty ridiculous. So I'm kind of calling that one out here. Do you remember anything about this show, Kristen? Or did you ever even kind of watch it?
I don't think I ever watched it. I remember, you know, just everything about what you're saying in terms of like he had this sort of public meltdown, and rather than being like, this man really needs help, you know, Hollywood was like, let's give him a show.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is often the response in terms of when people are clearly, you know, distressed and suffering from, you know, any number of issues, you know, the response is often not to like try to help them, you know, it's to like just try to capitalize on it. And so, but I mean, yeah, he's, you know, I think the best acting, you know, comedic acting he ever did was in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where his sort of flat affect was, you know, used for it, you know, really, really funny effect. But in Two and a Half Men and in this, it's just like, he gives that kind of delivery where he always sounds like he's laughing at his own joke and like he's always about to break. And, you know, hey, that'll work for Seinfeld because Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David created a show that was really funny. Whereas if you're just, you know, kind of too amused by your own cleverness and yet you're not clever at all, like it's not a great look.
And it's so great that you bring up Seinfeld. You know, part of the joke eventually on Seinfeld was that Jerry was kind of a somewhat heartless person.
Yes.
They were all terrible. Yeah, exactly. And the show was very aware of that. And as we look back on some of the entertainment, certainly of this decade and previously, we'll kind of see these shows where it'll be like, oh, well, like the main character, he's a real, like, you know, on anger management, he was somebody who had been a baseball player and he had all these anger issues and all these kind of personal issues. Mm-hmm. But the joke was always ultimately like, oh, but, you know, he's kind of he's an okay guy deep down. And I suspect that, like, you know, it doesn't take too much imagination to look at these shows and be like, oh, this is like a window into the mind of a sociopath.
Yeah.
Like, or this is like, you know, constructed around the idea that this person deserves a show made about them, when in fact, if anything, it's the people around them who have to deal with him, who probably have a very different perspective on him. This really kind of stands out to me, you know, as much as I do think there are comedies that were more obviously a waste of good talent. This was just kind of a waste of all time and just a real kind of cheap attempt to cash in, which did not really produce anything good. So that is my pick for worst comedy.
Well, I have to say, cheap attempt to cash in is a great segue for the worst reality of the decade. And my choice is I Want to Marry Harry, which aired on Fox from May to June in 2014. A knockoff of a knockoff of a knockoff, I Want to Marry Harry aired 4 episodes in May and June of 2014, the show in which 12 single women competed for the affections of a British ginger they thought was Prince Harry, but was actually just a commoner named Matthew Hicks. It was a variation on Fox's infamous dating show, Joe Millionaire, which itself was a tawdry variation on ABC's successful dating show, The Bachelor. I Want to Marry Harry was one in a long line of the Fox Network's twisted attempts to replicate the Bachelor franchise. You had Mr. Personality, The Guys Wore Masks, Monica Lewinsky hosted. You had More to Love, Plus Size, The Bachelor. You had The Littlest Groom, Dwarf, The Bachelor. And you had Playing It Straight, which was The Bachelorette, but some of the men are secretly gay. So the show itself, I Want to Marry Harry, was a paint-by-numbers reality show, but what really galls me is that producers couldn't even find a decent Harry lookalike. The dude wasn't even a real redhead. He was blonde, and he dyed his hair for the quote-unquote role. I love the royal family, particularly Princess Diana's 2 sons, so I find this show particularly egregious in the way it exploited the royals and did a shitty job of it, too. So the show aired in 2014, which is the year after Mike Darnell, who was Fox's evil genius president of alternative programming, left the network. And you know what? He once told EW's own Dan Snearson when he was at Fox that he hoped one day to produce a female prisoner beauty pageant. And honestly, I would have rather watched that. Did you watch I Want to Marry Harry? Or do you remember it?
I do remember, Kristen. I didn't watch it. I'm decidedly less invested in the royal family in general than you are. So the idea of watching a knockoff version of the royal family is about as much fun as the idea of drinking, like, you know, Safeway Select brand Pepsi to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm so glad you mentioned Mike Darnell. I worry sometimes that kids today haven't really heard so much about him. He is such a, like, do you remember? Because I think he was still at Fox when they did Joe Millionaire.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That's, you know, you were kind of talking about all these attempts to do The Bachelor, except with a twist. And that's what I always remember, is just being so absurd and delightful and ridiculous and stupid.
He is the man. Remember, he's the man who brought us the 300-pound tumor in the Guinness World Records. I mean,
oh God,
but it's
sad because so much of what he did, and whether it was puerile or whether it was like ridiculous, there was often a sense of humor behind it. I thought, and just, I don't know, the way you're describing this, it just sounds like, you know, dumb concept, dumb execution. Why is this happening? No sense of humor. No one there is even really fully committing to it. God, that's so. And there was no season 2 of this, I assume.
No, right? There was not. They didn't even air the full season, and like some lady quote unquote won, but then, you know, whatever.
must have been a victory for her. worst reality, I'm going in a different genre direction.
Sure.
Because Kristen, apparently I really enjoy docu-soaps.
Yes,
apparently that's my
I know you
thing,
do.
Is the kind of lifestyle reality shows. And the one I'm picking out, we're going way back to 2010 here, Kristen, because A&E briefly and quite unmemorably had a show called The Hasselhoffs. Do you remember?
Oh my God.
The Hasselhoffs?
I think I do.
So, as you would expect, this is basically an attempt to do the Osbournes,
yep,
but for the Hasselhoffs. This show aired not long after David Hasselhoff had a whole kind of, I don't want to say a scandal, but he'd clearly been struggling with some personal issues.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a hamburger thing.
Yep,
it went viral.
Yep.
I don't even want to really go into it. But what always troubled me about this show, besides the fact that it was very boring, it was David Hasselhoff. It was David Hasselhoff and his daughters. And, I mean, again, I'm not saying the Osbournes was great television, but again, a show like this, it goes pretty far with a sense of humor, which this one was trying to have and definitely did not.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of had David Hasselhoff narrating his life and narrating the lives of his 2 daughters. And what always struck me about it was that, you know, what made the Osbournes interesting viewing,
mm-hmm,
was that it was kind of taking one of the most extreme versions of stardom, like Ozzy Osbourne, you know, what he was and you know, biting a head off of a bird and all this stuff, and just totally cutting it off at the knees. I mean, you know, we're so used to that idea now with celebrities,
yeah.
but that was really a kind of exciting and hilarious thing to see. And
for
you were
sure.
really seeing those people at their most, you know, I don't want to say the most realistic, but there was certainly an effort to be like, you know, we're going to kind of look behind the curtain here. And with this one, it just all felt like a brand deposit for someone,
yeah.
David Hasselhoff, who really didn't understand that he was having some issues. You know, on the show, he kind of addressed the issues that he'd been having, and he kind of said, you know, I've learned a lot from it. But it just felt as if the show and he were capitalizing so much on notoriety. And you never want to feel when you're watching a reality show, Kristen, like it's like the mere act of watching it is making the people's lives on screen much, much worse because it's teaching them the wrong decision. It's teaching them, yeah, like I should do this. Now I'm on television. This is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to say good on you, America, for not making this show a hit. But I do think it always stands out to me. There was a line where, you know, Hasselhoff, who was narrating, would talk about how, oh, it's a real hassle to be a Hoff. And it just seemed like someone who was getting all the wrong messages about, you know, how he was interacting with the world and what the world was expecting of him. And, you know, we obviously, you know, now over the course of this decade, the Hasselhoff as a show would probably just be a very active Instagram account.
Yeah.
And so I don't think the lesson has been learned, if that makes any sense.
No, for sure. And, you know, you're so right about what you said regarding the Osbournes, because at the time, like the idea of watching Ozzy Osbourne struggle to put a trash bag in his trash can, because
yes!
he like that was fascinating.
So interesting.
It was like the first television sort of representation of stars. They're just like us, you know, they're funny, and they were funny people. They're funny people. And then, you know, everybody sort of jumped on that train, and it became this thing where, like, you know, you can show a celebrity, quote unquote, living his or her normal life, but if they are not interesting or entertaining people, nobody's going to want to watch it. You know, the Osbournes were funny. It had the novelty of this sort of celeb reality genre, which was it helped create, and it also had a cast of characters who were really interesting people.
Exactly right. You know, I always think of something, Kristen, that was said in the most recent reunion of the Real Housewives of New York City. I guess I shouldn't say I always think of it because it literally just happened. But, you know, a lot of the housewives were kind of felt like Tinsley Mortimer's big problem is she doesn't really reveal a lot of herself on a show. And, like, you know, I'm not going to say that Real Housewives is a confessional, intensive look into the interior lives of the frequently ridiculous people who are on screen. But I do think with reality television, you're very aware of when people are going the extra mile to kind of present some close approximation of the truth of their lives on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hasselhoffs is the polar opposite of that, where you're just like, no, you're doing this because you think it'll be good for your career.
Right.
And because, and God help us, you think you're funny.
Yeah.
which was definably not the case. So that's why Hasselhoffs is my pick for worst reality TV amidst a true vast and wild assortment of reality television that aired in the 2010s.
So many options, but that's a very good pick. A very good bad pick. So our final category is drama and, you know, the big kahuna and a lot of options again. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this off air, Darren, where we, you know, do we go with something just that's so stupid like that ABC show Magic Cop, or do we go with something, it wasn't called that, but you know what I mean? Or do we go with, you know, something that is, you know, more deeply offensive or deeply problematic? And I went with the latter. My choice is Criminal Minds, which premiered in 2005 and will end next year with its 15th and final season. Back in 2012, Mandy Patinkin, who starred in Criminal Minds from 2005 to 2007, said that joining the show was, quote, the biggest public mistake I ever made. He went on to criticize the content of the series, which is about a group of profilers from the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit. He said, quote, I never thought they were going to kill and rape all these women every night, every day, week after week, year after year. But kill and rape women, Criminal Minds did and continues to do week after week. The hit CBS drama returns in January for its final season, and from its very first episode, in which a killer kidnaps women and holds them in a cage for a week before murdering them, Criminal Minds has showcased an endless variety of depraved and disgusting ways to torture and kill women, pouring acid in their eyes, season 6, exsanguinating women and cutting their eyelids off, crushing their bones while they're still alive, decapitating them, strangling them, and stuffing them into suitcases, and so on and so on. While the show also maims, mutilates, and murders men and children, too, its general mission has been one of sort of gender-specific torture porn. It loves to fetishize and dramatize violence against women. You know, there are plenty of other shows that like to brutalize women, but none of them do it with such dedication and consistency and pure, unadulterated masochism as Criminal Minds. Even something as voyeuristic and sexploitative as Law & Order SVU has redeeming qualities, specifically the idea that all victims of sexual assault and abuse deserve to have a tireless, dedicated team of cops working to bring them justice. With Criminal Minds, though, it's just about grim-faced people wallowing in the most debauched and evil scenarios that the writers can conjure up. And I guess I would say, as my last little note about Criminal Minds, Thomas Gibson, he was a cast member who eventually was fired from the show for his on-set behavior. Just if you want to do yourself a favor, if you need a laugh, just Google Thomas Gibson and hot tub. That's all I'm going to say.
Kristen, it's funny you mentioned Thomas Gibson, because whenever I've watched Criminal Minds, which I've always done quite grudgingly, his role on the show, there's a special place in history for the nominally heroic crime solvers on television who, when you watch them, you just feel that they are playing the bad guy.
Right.
And you know, like there's a great kind of stretch of the wonderful documentary Los Angeles Plays Itself that's all about like Dragnet and how like and how viewed from today, something about Joe Friday, who I loved watching the show when I was a kid, but it can seem quite off-putting, just the totally humorless quality. And that was always what I felt with Thomas Gibson on this show and with this show in general. You know, Kristen, we've both kind of become very interested in the new series Evil on CBS, which, minor and not the craziest thing that happened in the episode, spoiler alert, recently threw a baby in the pool. And what was funny talking about that with a lot of people is, you know, I know a lot of people who watch that episode who don't watch much CBS, who nevertheless kind of expressed, wow, I can't believe CBS would do this.
Yeah.
And there is this sort of sense of CBS as, oh, well, you know, it's the kind of more archaic network, it's the older network, mm-hmm. it skews older and its viewers, and you know, and that would seem to imply it's somewhat as sanitized entertainment, and that is way not the case regards to Criminal Minds and a lot of their procedurals. And I always think that this show is kind of patient zero for redefining like just the utter violence of mainstream entertainment and what that's kind of done to our definition of mainstream entertainment. So I'm glad that you're kind of calling it out, because it doesn't seem as if, even though the show is ending, I think that its curious influence will continue.
Oh, I agree.
Kristen, I am going to call out a show that was much less long-lasting than Criminal Minds. And in terms of influence, I would say it kind of reflects being influenced in all the wrong ways rather than influencing in all the wrong ways. But when I think of just bad, awful television that made me want to throw my TV out the window and go into the woods for the rest of my life, with my family, not
as
a hermit.
Of course,
And only if they wanted to, and probably only for like a weekend. It's AP. APB from 2017, APB, which aired on the Fox network.
I love how much you hate this show.
He's been trying to explain this show. So the show is basically what would happen if a tech CEO, you know, those people who you hate now because they have done everything they can to ruin democracy and to make billions of dollars while making our life miserable. And I don't know, maybe there are people out there who still feel strongly defensive about people like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg. And, you know, I'm sure there are aspects of what Silicon Valley has done to our lives that we'll someday say, well, okay, there are positives and negatives. But in 2018... I don't think there were a lot of people who were like, let's make a hero out of these people. What APB presupposes is, what if an Elon Musk type decided to fix the crime problem in Chicago by giving the police a shit ton of weapons?
Oh, my God.
And it's just like, you know, I don't want to get too political here, and the show's problems are more so that it's just really, really dumb and basically just RoboCop without a sense of humor. But, you know, this show, from its pilot on through the few episodes that I could stomach, it just seemed to be doing something that I think a lot of television was doing, especially in the last half of this decade, where it was kind of saying, you know what, we're going to kind of address some stuff that's going on right now.
Right.
And then just doing it in the worst way possible. The show was very derivative. The introduction to Gideon Reeves, the character played by Justin Kirk, who was the fake Elon Musk. It was very clearly influenced by the Iron Man movies and this idea of we're going to have this multi-billion dollar tech CEO who's a funny guy and has a kind of witty sense of humor. And boy, oh boy, nothing will make you love Robert Downey Jr. more than seeing a bloated... you know, an attempt to capture that and do it very, very badly.
Yeah.
But I just feel that, you know, there was something so totally point missing at a time when, you know, how we talk about Law and Order in general has become really complicated in an exciting and important and urgent way, to kind of just say, what we need to do is let Silicon Valley take this over. It was so totally wrongheaded. It did not last very long. And again, this is me saying, great job, America. which is not something that we often get to say these days.
No. So. And what I found so, I mean, so many of the things that the show are so stupid, but like what I found incredibly fascinating and stupid was that they had the Elon Musk character like basically move in full time to the Chicago Police Department headquarters.
He was given ownership over a precinct.
Yeah, and he like went there every day and like ran crime scenes and was like, you know, sort of flying the remote controlled drone to like get the bad guy at crime scenes, like from the precinct. Like, I'm sorry, you're a billionaire tech person, like, don't you have an actual job? And like, do you have any law enforcement experience?
Yeah.
And
none,
like, no,
none.
But they're like, okay, rich that white seemed, man, come on in.
That's exactly, that seemed to be the thinking, was like, well, you know, we've failed at this. We, living in Chicago, a city that is very multiracial and that has all kinds of particular issues that, you know, like any city, have to be solved. Let's let this rich white guy come in and solve them. I mean, it's just like, it's almost, I kind of goes back to what I was saying, like, it's almost a horror idea that the show just played in such the wrong direction. And that really, you know, everything you're saying, I think, really captures the feel of the show and like, the feel of what it was going for.
I feel like if they had just kind of changed a few elements of the tone, it could have been The Hunt, you know? Like,
yes. Like, no, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And instead, I mean, again, it was just, you know, it was stupid. It was really expensive and silly. And each episode, they would kind of be using different cool technology.
Yeah.
And it just seemed, you know, especially after this year, I think that there's still so much that network television can do.
Mm-hmm.
But this was certainly an example of kind of network television at its most, just stuffed full of all kinds of badness and trying to be mainstream in the worst way. So that's my pick that stands out as the worst drama of the 20-teens.
Wow. I mean, we had a pretty well-rounded list of crap, didn't we?
We somehow fit in David Hasselhoff.
Yeah.
We fit in the royal family. We got robots. We got the Bluths. We got poor Murphy Brown, who now we can go back to just remembering the good times that we had with her back in the
90s. Yes.
But Kristen, that wraps it up for this episode of Best of Shows. We do want to hear from everybody out there. I'd love to hear from the fans of APB. If you are out there, let's have a good long conversation about the show, because frankly, you're the only other ones who ever watched the show. So let us know what you think. We're on Twitter. She's at Kristen G. Baldwin. I'm at Darren Franich. While you're letting us know how you feel, give us a rating, give us a review. We are everywhere that you find your podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, Spotify. We're having such a fun time right now in our little mini-series all about the best TV of the 20-teens, and we want to hear what you think and what we can do going forward. Until next week, I should have a catchphrase, but I don't, so goodbye.